Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, please sit back because you are now about to go behind the blue curtain.
Radio? Is that the way you heard it?
Yeah.
So you were driving, you left that gas station at 2nd and Linden, what, about 6 or?
I don't have any way of knowing. I think it's around that time, but I don't even know if it's Linden. I know the approximate area it is. And I've seen the map on the Inquirer.
And you were going back to pick up this man that you say is Raul?
No, I just waiting the car back.
So you heard all this confusion? They turned and flipped on the radio. They said Dr. King's been shot. Did you think you were set up at that point?
No, I was headed toward New Orleans when I had the radio. And I used to keep the radio on. I think I didn't have too strong feelings about the shooting.
When you met Raul, you didn't know any other name for him. That's the name that he said was his, and that's all you ever knew.
Yeah, I guess so. Mm-hmm.
And you met him where?
Canada.
Up in Canada. Yeah. And you just met in a saloon, or?
It was a saloon in a waterfront area of Montreal. Mm-hmm.
You never became good friends then?
No, I wasn't good friends. Mm-hmm. Just business. Mm-hmm. These were all aliases, I assume.
You don't think Raul was a real name at all, then, huh?
No, I've got some Freedom of Information papers in there saying there's Raul San Diego or something. New Orleans is supposed to be him, but I don't have the FBI's material from the FBI files, but I don't have nothing to substantiate that.
So you think their mind was made up when they got you?
Well, it had to be made up. They couldn't... Well, I don't know if there's any penalty for extraditing someone fraudulently or not, but I think I can see their legal point where they've got to stick with their story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that, ladies and gentlemen, was James Earl Ray. And as I said right now, ladies and gentlemen, all rise. The judge is in the house, and this is the preeminent expert right now. As far as to what happened, did not happen, what the evidence said, did not say, in reference to James Earl Ray. And without further ado, Pop, Judge Joe Brown, are you in the house?
All right, son, I'm here. Judge is in the house.
Yes, sir. So let's just go on and get straight into it.
Okay.
On the
what you want to know?
You were the presiding judge on James Earl Ray's final appeal, correct?
Yeah, right. He had filed with a conviction relief. That's after the appellate process was over, and he kept raising issues. See, he never, contrary to what you hear in the press, which is the self-confessed killer of Dr. King, that's not true. He never confessed. He always denied killing King, but he was entering a plea of guilty under the theory of a moderately old U.S. Supreme Court case that was known as Alford versus North Carolina. That's spelled A-L-F-O-R-D. The case stood for the principle that a person who was pristinely innocent could plead guilty if he thought it was in his best interest to do so. And Ray expressed on the record over and over again that he feared getting the death penalty because he had a prior criminal record. That being the case, a person would be permitted to enter a plea of guilty, even if they were innocent, so long as they did so freely and voluntarily, understandingly, knowingly, advisedly, and intelligently, and the state otherwise had a reasonable factual basis upon which to proceed with the prosecution. In other words, they couldn't rely just upon a person's plea of guilty. They had to have some facts with which to go forward. Now, Ray had exhausted all of the front part over through various proceedings. And the issue was whether there was a factual basis upon which to proceed. So when you get into the record, the only factual basis upon which they were proceeding was that Ray's Remington 760 Game Master rifle was the murder weapon. Now, there was a big flaw in this whole case from the very beginning because the entity that the state was relying upon to establish that this was a murder weapon was the FBI. And the FBI ballistics report stated without equivocation they could not make a match between Ray's rifle and the weapon that fired the bullet that killed King. Now, when I got into the record, I discovered that the FBI had essentially faked the test, and the very first judge, the late Honorable Preston Battle, had also taken a look at that set of ballistic reports and had found in an order he entered into the record that the ballistics report was inadequate, and he ordered the rifle retested. Well, for some reason, it's not quite clear from the record, that rifle was not retested, and that languished for years and years until I finally got my order complied with and the retest run. Well, one of the big problems is that there is a myth about how great the FBI is in these things, and they simply aren't. Their ballistics tests were rather pathetically inadequate, and also there were some memoranda that came to light that were in the file, and those memoranda were clear the FBI was deliberately faking the test. There were some memoranda from Hoover. It went around, and that resulted in some, responses. The director wishes to know how soon test could be run on the bullet material and the rifle. And the memo came back about 30-some days, and it would take about 35 or 40 days to get an adequate report done. So there's another memoranda set in there that says the director wishes this report, the tentative report, to be prepared within 3 days and submitted to agent so-and-so for review. That would reflect the director's wishes. So in other words, come up with something bogus and do it in 3 days, and they did that. Mm-hmm. And there's an exchange saying that what the proposal looks like is okay by the director. Prepare an official report dated accordingly to previous discussions. In other words, fake it and date it 30 days from hence. And submit it to so-and-so for further processing. So they fired the test bullets they were using to do the evaluation into some cut-up yellow pads, which with the staples and the cardboard were basically intended to strip the fine striations off of the test bullets so they couldn't make an affirmative yay or nay conclusion. There is a thing that a lot of prosecutors do these days wherein they don't want an exact ballistics match because that match may come up not really a match. What they may come up with is this weapon is excluded from being the murder weapon. They don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
They want something with this is a weapon that is consistent with the type of weapon that was used to kill so on and so on. In other words, it's a Smith & Wesson 38 special, and there are hundreds of thousands of those in circulation, if not millions, and that just says, okay, fine, this could be the person or this could be the weapon without it being specific about it. Well, what actually is shown by scanning electron microscopy analysis that I had done on the death slug that was removed from King's body, or at least the pieces of it, since the FBI cut the jacket into three pieces and the core mm-hmm. into three pieces. Why, there's no apparent reason, but they did. They had said that the bullet had been too badly mangled to test, which it was not. It had everything necessary relative to the base of the bullet that you need to do a ballistic analysis. And it ultimately proved that bullet that was taken out of King was fired by what was essentially a 30 caliber weapon with a rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 11 and a quarter inches. That means that if the bullet traveled down the barrel of the weapon that fired it 11 and a quarter inches, it would turn over one time. Now, Ray's rifle was a 30 caliber rifle, but it had a rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 10 inches. In other words, the rifle twist was not slow enough. So that was clear and without equivocation on all of the tests that were run on Ray's rifle. It also had a manufacturing defect in the barrel, which clearly showed up on the sample bullets. I threw a red herring out on the record when I started talking about that, and I wanted to see where the state was going. Now, the state, I think, contrived to frame Ray. One of the reasons I reached that conclusion is because, believe it or not, the Homicide Bureau of the Memphis Police Department was without equivocation in its determination that Ray was not the gun. They even noted that Ray was not even in Memphis on the day King was killed. So I'm finding it rather peculiar that the prosecution insisted on prosecuting somebody that the Homicide Bureau said is not the killer, but they insisted. So we have that situation. Now, let's get back to something else. They picked the wrong judge for this case, actually is by random rotational assignment, but they got the wrong one for purposes of doing what they were trying to do and getting away with it. Mm-hmm. I had been qualified before and ultimately wound up testifying in front of a jury in a matter, civil trial brought by the King family, as an expert in ballistics, and I knew something was funny. The pictures of the death slug that they pulled out of King revealed mushrooming, but it was consistent with a rifle that had been fired from 300-400 yards away, which is a long distance, and a survey of the area did not reveal any obvious point from 300-400 yards away from which a shot could have been fired. I know that the popular myth is that the shot was fired from the flop house or from the bushes. But had the bullet been fired from that distance and it was fired out of a conventional weapon, in no way would it have been as intact as it was when it was removed from King's body. So that indicated to me that there was a reduction in the velocity of the bullet from the point of its firing for some purpose. So that gave me a clue, and I started doing research, and I found an interesting thing, an invoice for 5 rifles that went to the Psionics, that came from the Psionics company through the Defense Department to the FBI, December 1967. These rifles in question were essentially standard M14 rifles that had been selected for their tight tolerances. The barrels had been removed from the action and replaced by special stainless steel barrels made by the Army Marksmanship Unit. The barrels had, guess what? A rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 11 and a quarter inches. They made approximately 62 or 63 of these weapons, and the Defense Department was hot to issue them to various entities in Vietnam for start of an experiment using a semi-auto sniper system. They had been using Remington bolt actions before that, a Winchester Model 70 bolt actions, and they wanted a semi-auto system. Psionics is a company that manufactured suppressors. people call them silencers, but they really don't silence the weapon. They just reduce the sound signature. Also, Psyonix made this MAC-10 that you see in a lot of the 70s action-adventure movies. It's a very small, compact submachine gun in 45 caliber. Well, Psyonix put its suppressor on the barrel of these weapons, and they installed a modified Redfield telescopic sight. It was a variable between 3 and 9 power. It had been modified by a company known as Leatherwood so that when you adjusted the power ring, you also adjusted the mount so it could be accommodated to various ranges. So you did not have to hold off. You could just dial it in and be spot on. The other thing that went along with the condition of the ammunition was that there was epoxy at the base of the bullet, which was unusual. I also discovered that along with the invoice for these 5 rifles that matched the ballistics characteristics necessary to have fired the bullet that killed King, there was a quantity of about 5,000 rounds of special ammunition that was loaded subsonic. And this ammunition had epoxy of the same type that was put in the case to reduce its capacity. Bingo, that's circumstantial evidence that says, A, that's the type of rifle relative to the rifling twist. B, that's the type of ammunition relative to what was pulled out of King's body. And C, relative to the big scheme, this was a custom setup and very few people had access to a custom gunsmith, A, to make a barrel with a rate of rifling twist of 1 11 11 1/4 inches. And this ammunition was hand-loaded because the bullets were of two kinds, Spear and Sierra, which were not loaded into factory ammunition. They had to be custom-loaded. So here we have 5,000 rounds of the type of ammunition and 5 of the weapons of the type used. Well, the Defense Department wanted these weapons back, and they raised all kinds of hell about it because the FBI did not have a hostage rescue squad at that time, and there was no apparent need that the FBI had for 5 sniper rifles. So in late April, this is after the King shooting, on a demand, the FBI inventoried their weapons, and they could only find 4 of these rifles and claimed that the 5th one got lost for in some fashion they did not know. It's enough circumstantial evidence to have gone after the FBI. They got the weapons, they got the type of ammunition, and after the fact, one of the weapons is said to be missing. Now, I had the serial numbers for all 5 of these, so the missing serial number is, in fact, the murder weapon. But in any event, there was a Tommy Smith, who was the first detective on the scene approximately 10 or 15 minutes after the shooting, and he ultimately retired as chief of the Homicide Bureau as Captain Tommy Smith. I was present when he gave a statement that when he arrived at the Lorraine Motel, not the Lorraine Motel, when he arrived at the flop house across from the Lorraine Motel, where he had been directed by the dispatcher, he reached the conclusion that it was impossible for a shot to have been fired from the flophouse bathroom because there was a tree growing between the bathroom window and the Lorraine Motel, and you couldn't even see the hotel. So he indicates that approximately 1 hour later, when they went to take pictures, they noted that the tree had been cut down and was laying there on the ground. They discovered that a cut-down order had been put out to have that tree cut down at approximately 9 o'clock that morning. But since it was to be done by the sanitation department, which was on strike, the tree did not get cut down. They also said they had been walking in and out of the flop house looking and investigating for about an hour, when all of a sudden one of the detectives was walking out and says, "Come here, guys, take a look at this." And there is the rifle laying right there in the hallway going out to the street, along with, guess what, a radio that had a plaque riveted to it listing Ray's prison ID and all of the particulars, and he had had it when he was in the penitentiary. Yeah, where did he come from? We've been in and out of here for the last hour, and now all of a sudden it shows up. I'm sure Ray came back to leave it. Now, the other thing is the state has in its record an affidavit from a man and a woman claiming that they'd seen Ray around the flop house all morning long, which is kind of strange since he would have had to have been in the only public bathroom for the flop house with a rifle for about 4.5 hours, since there was a delay in King traveling from the Lorraine Motel over to Reverend Billy Kyle's home for a scheduled dinner. Now let's get into that. Detective Smith indicates that for the rest of his career, 25 more years, he spent trying to find out how a call was generated from dispatch to him to go to the flop house, and he never could get an answer. But back to these two people that gave the affidavit that Ray was in the flop house. He says when he got there, he discovered them in a room. The male was passed out in a pool of urine on a bed, and the female had no panties on and had her dress hiked up above her hips, passed out in a pool of urine. They could not be revived, and they were taken to the emergency room, and the female had a blood alcohol level of 0.72, and the male had 1.76. Now, that's interesting because that's approximately twice the fatal alcohol level for most human beings. And the only reason they survived after being in ICU for several days was because they were confirmed alcoholics. Captain Smith also indicated that he checked with a cab company that he located who had gotten a call to go pick these two individuals up about 15 minutes before the killing, and when the cab driver got there, he stated that he discovered them in the same condition Smith found them, and he could not revive them, so he left. That's interesting, and somehow or another, these two individuals were able to produce an affidavit swearing that they had seen Ray up to the point where King was assassinated around there, and that's simply untrue because they were almost dead. We get into another situation, which is, where did this shot come from? You see people indicating that it was from the bushes, but the fact of the matter is that there may have been somebody with a rifle behind the bushes, but he was an off-duty cop. Now, he's not the gunman, and the rifle in question was not what was going to be used for the killing. And it looks like there had been a claim that this person was on sort of an overwatch. Well, the problem with that is although you might not have seen the person with the rifle in the bushes from the Lorraine Motel, and that's only speculation because the individual denies that he was there, you could clearly see the person from Main Street because he would have been between the bushes and the street, which passed right in front of the fire station and in front of the flop house and was regularly populated with pedestrian traffic. We have a scene where at first King is supposed to go over to Kyle's home, but that's called off, and Kyle's calls home, according to an affidavit we have from his ex-wife, late ex-wife, and she says the food was ready, but she was told that they couldn't come quite yet. So then there's another call later saying we still can't come. And at this point, she says she was rather disturbed because she didn't want her cooking to be criticized for the meal being dried out. It was still in the stove warming. And then there's a third call saying we still can't come. So after that, another call comes in, number four, we are on our way. Well, what has happened is that matching the timeline, there are six black detectives and or sergeants who have on their own formed a security squad for Dr. King. They are told that threats have been received against their lives and that they'll have to leave and come downtown to the main station. They refuse, and finally they are ordered to leave by their superior, who comes down there and face-to-face tells them, you have to leave here. So they go on downtown. Meanwhile, they discover that there is one black fireman at the fire station, so there is a delay on the timeline that matches when they advised the black fireman that one of his sons had been badly injured. So he took off to go see to it and discovered that fortuitously his son was in fine condition, that the report was false. Well, there is another call off in there when he calls back and says, I'm on my way back to the station, and they have to get with him and tell him, don't worry about it, take the day off. Okay. Then there's another black cop who's at the fire station on the roof on overwatch, and he refuses to leave. So he gives us an affidavit that not only did they force him to leave, they had 10 of his white colleagues come down there, double handcuff him, and hog tie him with a rope, and forcibly removed him and literally threw him in the back seat of the squad car that they were transporting him away from the scene in. So at this point, we get the okay. We get a number of things that I find suspect, from one individual talking about he had to wash his face in some aftershave lotion so he didn't go out. Another individual who got King, who was headed down the hallway to go out of the other side of the hotel, motel, and bring him back on the representation that some of his fans were out by the pool and wanted to see him. And that individual, Reverend Billy Kyles, ducks back in the hotel. Mm-hmm. And years later, Dick Gregory interviews him and tapes him. Mm-hmm. And on the tape that was played on We All Be, a show put on by a very good brother named Ron Hurd, Kyles is asked by Dick Gregory, why did you duck back in the hotel? And Kyle said, I didn't want to be shot. So Gregory jumps him and said, how did you know somebody was going to shoot somebody? He said, well, I just kind of figured it. And then Gregory jumps him about it being a fraud and a slip. But anyway, the bullet that comes out of King hits him in the right cheek, takes out some molars, does a lot of damage, exits between his lower jaws, leaves the body, hits him right above the clavicle, deflects under the tough skin at the neck, along the clavicle, really does some bad damage to the carotid arteries, to a carotid artery. That's what kills him, and he bleeds out very quickly, but it travels down through the thick skin over the shoulder, down across the scapula on the right side, across the back, and winds up between the left scapula and the left back skin. That sounds a little freak, but it's not unusual with a bullet for it to come in, hit somebody. It looks like it's gone straight through, but it, say, hit ribs and deflected along the ribs and come out the back looking like somebody's gotten shot straight through the chest when actually he hasn't, and it's a flesh wound. But this is what happened with Dr. King. There is a urban myth going around on Twitter right now that he was alive and they took him to the wrong hospital, and when he was in the hospital, they smothered him to kill him. Well, no, he didn't make it off the balcony alive. That wrecked his carotid artery. He quickly bled out. A lot of the blood did not get on the ground or on the landing on the balcony landing because it was trapped in the body because the bullet stayed inside the body. There is damage that's that's obviously there. You can see it in the pictures of the body when they take it in for autopsy, and from the autopsy report, it's clear what happened. And from eyewitnesses and people on the scene and also from the ambulance report, he did not make it off of the balcony alive. Now, there were two individuals on top of the fire station who took film footage of what happened, and they indicate they did not develop the film, they did not look at it, but they turned it in as directed. Now, that's interesting because the shot did not come from the flop house. It did not come from the bushes. It came from the fire station dormitory. There were some narrow sliding windows that were on the second floor of that station, and they were slightly cracked open. The rifle was set up on a table bolted to the floor about 10, 15 feet inside of that window. It had a suppressor on it. It was firing ammunition that had a special reduced velocity. In other words, it was not going supersonic. The bullet was not going supersonic. That would reduce the sound signature. And there is an affidavit from one of the people who was present. And the affidavit is interesting. Ordinarily, with a high-powered rifle, the bullet hits before you hear the sound because it's traveling twice the speed of sound. And you also get a crack, which is a minor sonic boom. In this case, the person says, I bent down and I heard the shot and I heard the thump when the bullet hit King, and I turned around and looked, and to my horror, he had been hit. That indicated that the bullet was traveling less than the speed of sound, which is the intent. Sound travels at about 1,100 some feet per second at sea level. If it is traveling at 1,100 feet per second and you've got a 162 grain bullet, which is what King was shot with, that indicates that you have about the same energy as a pistol, which is why they took the head shot to begin with. If you've got a 30 caliber, 162 grain bullet traveling at 2,700 feet per second muzzle velocity, the energy is somewhere around a ton and a quarter, 2,300, 400, 500 foot-pounds of energy. With an expanding bullet at the 45-yard distance between the point of the shot and where King was hit, all you have to do is hit that person in the torso, and even if they're standing next to an emergency room, that's non-survivable. They're dead, considering the damage that's done. So they took a headshot, which they almost missed. And he got killed because fortuitously the bullet clipped the carotid artery after it deflected in its trajectory. And that killed King. He bled out right there. on the spot. Probably took about 25, 30 seconds for that to happen. So that's the long and the short. King got killed with a military weapon, an XM-21 7.62 NATO caliber rifle that was put together by the Psionics Corporation with a large suppressor on it, firing special hand-loaded subsonic ammunition, firing an aftermarket bullet that was not loaded commercially in ammunition that was available over the counter. Ray's rifle had a rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 7 inches, a one turn in every 10 inches. It was a 30-06. It was a pump-action rifle, and there's an affidavit in the record from the person that sold him the rifle, and it is to the effect that he came in and bought a 243 Remington 700 bolt-action rifle. He returned the next day and said he'd been instructed to get a 30-caliber weapon, and the only one they had in the shop was a 7.60 Remington Game Master, a pump, like a pump shotgun. Because the receiver is closed, there was no way to remove the bolt and do what they call bore sighting. That is, try to get the scope and the barrel aligned such that it would at least be on paper when you took it to the range to finish the sighting in process. He said, we did not have a collimator, so we did not even roughly sight in this weapon. And there is a report in the file showing that someone in Memphis fired the weapon the day after it came into their possession, and it hit 6 feet to the right and 4 feet low at 100 yards. Dr. Pepper, who was representing Ray, says it was the other way around, but that's my recollection from going down there and sitting for a long time looking through everything in the file. Anyway, the rifle was not able to hit the broadside of a barn from inside of the barn, but that's Ray's rifle. Also found in the rifle were 4 loaded cartridges and 1 fired empty case in the chamber. Interestingly enough, the metallurgical test they did on the bullet they pulled out of King's body showed that it did not match the metallurgical characteristics of the unfired bullets and the unfired cartridges that were in Ray's rifle found mysteriously in the hallway at the entrance exit of the flop house an hour after the cops had been walking in and out of there and nobody saw it. So anyway, that indicates that something's wrong. The whole thing with Ray is crazy because he gets caught at Heathrow Airport with a Canadian passport. And the only reason he was caught is because he didn't know whether he was a subject, a visitor, or a member of the Commonwealth and didn't know what line to get in going through customs at Heathrow in London, and that caused him to be brought to the attention of Her Majesty's authorities, and that's how they got it. He also had 3 other passports. The one that he was caught using was under the name of a live Canadian subject. The other 3 were in the names of 3 English subjects, all 3 of whom had the same date of birth as Ray, all 3 of whom matched his general description, and all 3 of whom were dead. One of whom had not had his death reported to the English equivalent of vital statistics, and the other 2 had been reported as dead, but interestingly enough, it had the reports of their death removed. Now, that just doesn't match up with Hillbilly Hick, 3-time loser, having operated by himself to have had the resources to remove those records from English vital statistics. It just isn't happening. Also, the FBI never backtracked Ray's first-class itinerary in Europe or airline fare. They didn't take the time to find out who had made it for him. So there's a lot wrong with this case. And then there is an interesting development that happened just a few years ago. I was approached by some individual who had done an algorithm for a computer program that's used by the Defense Department and the State Department. It's based on the theory that when humans talk, only 15% of what they're communicating consists of the words they use. 35% comes from the tone of voice, and 50% comes from the body language. So if you had a clear video clip of somebody speaking, you could use this algorithm, either just using the words and the tone of voice, or using the words, tone of voice, and the body language, with the body language being reduced to an animation. So the Defense Department wanted to calibrate this, and they thought Ray was going to be an outright pristine liar. So they rented 5 hours of tape, which came from the last taped interview of Ray while he was in the penitentiary. And they were shocked to discover that on their 0 to 34, 34 being absolutely truthful, Ray was up there 33, 34 for the 5 hours, with the exception of just two questions, which were basically, if you didn't do it, do you know who did it? And it came out right in the middle, which was either equivocation or ambivalence, or he did not know. So the reason they got upset was that they were military officers and they had taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. And they thought they were being required to deviate from that oath and what was going on down in Guantanamo. So they came to me when they realized that this sacrosanct federal agency, the FBI, and its famous director, J. Edgar Hoover, had been violating the law. So they said this was the same kind of thing that is now permitted under Homeland Security / Patriot legislation. So we don't want to be stuck in that position. So they brought it to my attention to see what I had thought about the rest of what was going on, since the word was around that I wasn't buying the conclusion that Ray shot King with a Remington 760 Game Master from the flop house. There's another little interesting thing in here, too. We wrecked 3760 Remington Game Masters by conducting an experiment. For Ray to have pulled off the hypothetical shot, assuming the tree was not in the way, from the flop house, he would have had to have rested the barrel over the window sill. That's the equivalent of a block of wood. So we took three of these Remington 760 Game Masters, rested the barrel on a block of wood, and pulled the trigger. And interestingly enough, the harmonics are such that the bolt releases before the pressure is dropped. It blows out the base of the cartridge and blast the extractor out of the side of the ejection port, so you ruin the rifle. It's easy to repair, which we did, but in all three times we tried it, we got the same result with different rifles of the same kind. So we knew something was crazy right there. And then you've got a report in the record, this dispatcher's recording of a so-called chase of Ray's white Mustang, which is now acknowledged to have been a complete fabrication. It didn't happen. So you had Claude Armour, who had been next before this incident, the fire commissioner and the police commissioner simultaneously in Memphis. And at the time of the killing, he was the fire commissioner, and somebody else had succeeded him as police commissioner. Now, Claude Armour had worked for J. Edgar Hoover. I interviewed Ray's brother for 5 or 6 hours on multiple occasions. And Jerry Ray, who wrote a book foreword for which I wrote indicates that in talking to his brother, James Earl Ray, it was clearly stated by Ray that the way he escaped was by hiding amongst loaves of bread baked in the bakery of the prison where he worked. This prison supplied all of its own bread and for the bread for several other state penitentiaries. So he hid in the bread. He clearly states to Jerry that he did not take his radio. He left that because he didn't want anybody to get suspicious before it was necessary that he had booked on up. So that's how he got out, hiding under loads of bread in a delivery truck. And interestingly enough, in the record, the APB All Points Bulletin that he had escaped had been removed at the behest of the FBI within 48 hours of his alleged escape, so they weren't looking for him.
Wow.
Now, from what I know about the record, it looks like Ray was one of four, maybe five alternative scapegoats that they had nearby, or at least involved in this conspiracy, which wasn't much of one, because unlike some of the urban mythology out there about the FBI saying, or some people implying that it was the mob that killed King, you see, when you have the mob involved, sometimes somebody gets one of them compromised and he talks. That isn't often, but we have enough historic cases where somebody got turned and they squealed. What was also the situation at that time was within a 150-mile radius, they had three reserve units that had large numbers of former Green Berets Special Forces types in them, and these people had been sniping and pulling the trigger through several tours of duty over in the NOM, and killing somebody was no big thing. You know, from what you do, that the first killing is kind of difficult for most humans, and then it gets easier. For some people, it gets too damn easy, but you didn't want a bozo out there who had never squeezed the trigger on anybody before. So they just got a call. You know, we want you to do a special assignment that will be good for the country. You're going to get rid of one of these ends who is too uppity. Sure, what do I have to do? So they go out and they train with the weapon. They have a mock-up of the facility where the target's going to be. They practice, and then they go do it. They squeeze the trigger. It's a two-man team. One's a spotter, one's a shooter. And when it's over, they leave the rifle right there, and an hour or two later, someone goes in and removes the rifle. End of situation. Rifle's destroyed. Nobody with any connection or anybody known to any of the principals out there on the ground. So that's how they do it. The other thing that I thought was peculiar is that, you know, these table 3D maps they do where they have small little miniature buildings. Well, they had one the next day, and that usually is something that takes, you know, a bunch of sergeants, corporals, a private, a two or three, and a second grade lieutenant in the engineering branch, and it takes them several days to put one together. But they had it the next day, so it looks like somebody had, you know, surveyed the scene at the Lorraine Motel. Now, there's something about the Lorraine Motel that's odd. At the time, the Lorraine Motel was part of the hoe track. That's where the pimps and hoes did their business, and the hoes turned their tricks. King had no business being there. Even the person who owned the Lorraine Motel at the time, a person named Walter Bailey, who, by the way, is not the same Walter Bailey as another one we have in Memphis that was a county commissioner and lawyer. His brother, the Army Bailey, is listed in a brass plaque, on a brass plaque, as the founder of the Civil Rights Museum. That's not true, by the way. Chuck Scruggs, me and Randy Wade met up at Mr. Bobo's restaurant down on Thomas Street for a couple of weeks, along with the Walter Bailey that owned the motel, and he wanted to sell it. And I came up with the idea to make a civil rights museum out of it, and that's what happened. And anyway, we had an A.W. Willis, a very conscientious black lawyer, who put all the paperwork together, got everything signed, and then he collapsed and died a week later. So his office got the Army Bailey's office to file the documents, and the Army listed himself as the founder, and that's all he did was take it to the post office. So that's the kind of stuff that's going on, and they wanted this rifle so they could have the murder weapon, and I asked them, begged them not to do it, because once they got it, that broke the chain of custody, and that makes it, guess mm-hmm. what? It's no longer valid evidence anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to go along with that, with their little bourgeoisie clique who wanted to have the weapon there. So when they had their little cheese and cracker nibbling sessions with wine, when they brought all of the VIPs in for fundraisers and their little boule things, they would have it. But in any event, Ray was just a scapegoat. He was probably most convenient because he wasn't there, as per the Memphis Police Department's investigation, so that made him the easiest one to set up.
If I remember correctly, he was on his way to New Orleans, if I remember correctly, when he heard about it. And at least that's what he said in his statement.
Yeah. And it looks like what he was doing is he was told if he wanted to be a national hero, go ahead and plead guilty and we'll take care of it a few months later. Well, they double-crossed him, of course, because the people he was talking to weren't the people that pulled it off and they didn't know much of anything. I found it interesting that J. Edgar Hoover personally issued an order to his FBI agents to call off all auditory and visual surveillance of King for the first time in many years. And that was 48 hours before the killing. Now, back to this thing about why King is at the Lorraine Motel. I digress. I'm sorry about that. Getting old, I guess. But anyway, King had been staying at the Rivermont Hotel, which was the flagship hotel for the Holiday Inn. It was considerable distance away. And the Rivermont was a hotel, the Holiday Inn, let me back up a bit. Holiday Inn was founded in Memphis. It moved away eventually, but at that time it was still headquartered in Memphis, and the Rivermont was their flagship hotel. King was doing what civil rights leaders do. He was integrating the hotel. So King left Memphis to do other things, and he really didn't want to come back, but they basically begged him to come back, and he was prevailed upon to do so. At that point, somebody said, "We want you to stay in the black community." Now, out of all the black hotels available, they put him in one that was a whole house. And I find it interesting to consider Lorraine Motel being 45 yards across the street from the fire station, where they had a secure place from which to take the shot. They did a table map of it, and that table map had already been made by the time King was slain. And the juxtaposition of these people coming in from a military reserve unit who had done sniping and who were the ones who apparently pulled the trigger on it. Also, Memphis was peculiar at that point in 1968 because of its juxtaposition on a scene where a lot of black folk had been killed. Medgar Evers was killed less than 60 miles away. Those three young civil rights workers who were killed and buried in a levee, that was 60, 70 miles away. You had Emmett Till lynched within 60 miles of Memphis. You had one of the biggest confrontations in American history between blacks and whites just over in Arkansas, about 50 miles away, about 50 years before that. And it was an area where black people were killed with impunity. It is also the first degree murder capital of the United States. And by that, I'm not talking about street crime. I'm talking about criminal activity where it's planned and set up and it's listed as an accident or unsolved. Like, for example, we had a great barbecue place here. I suspected for a long time that they laundered money, and then there was a problem with that. And on a Wednesday night, the proprietor died in a one-car wreck on the freeway at about 3:15 in the morning. Thursday, his general manager died at the same place in a one-car wreck, no witnesses, same time in the morning. And Friday, his chief accountant died at the same place, one-car wreck, no witnesses, same location, same time in the morning. Coincidence? Well, that's just typical of what happened in Memphis, and that was much later than the King killing. So we have a whole lot of incidents in Memphis where black folk who were being active got killed. We had one over on Shannon Street was rather notorious. They had the sheriff's department's negotiating team there, some from the police department, but they didn't want that done. And as the police were being told, these guys are being talked to by their neighbors on the phone, but you can't seem to get to them, and you got your negotiators here. Why don't you let them to come out? Well, I went in with the FBI's team. They asked me as a person with community credibility. I went in and took 400 pictures. And when the FBI got in there, this last shootout kind of got looked a little bit weird because where the bodies were located, at least where the brain material and skull fragments were, you got some interesting bullet holes, which when lined up with the rods showed that the shots came from the doorways to the bedroom while these people were lined up head, foot on the floor, and they weren't shot while they were moving around. I mean, that's also Memphis. And even where the coroner, this guy, Dr. Jerry Francisco, he got to be considered as so bogus that whenever there was a controversial case, the county commission set up a fund to bring in an outside medical examiner to verify or look over the work done. He's the same person who did not perform the autopsy on the dead man, but he's the one that issued the report that Elvis died of a heart attack, not a drug overdose, as everybody else indicated on the autopsy.
Dr. Nicopoulos. Excuse me, Stan, can I ask Dr. Brown a question? I'm on my
on the
train. Yes, Judge Brown, it's a pleasure to hear everything that you said, sir. And being 55 years of age, I've heard all sorts of investigations. And I want to thank you very much for your work on this case. I just have one question, sir, and I hope I don't lose you. Mr. Lloyd Jowers, who owned a restaurant, when you were talking about all these
I know,
different...
I know Jowers. Jowers is a psycho. He's a psycho, and he's a glory hound. He was one of perhaps four or five alternative scapegoats. And Jowers knew that nobody was going to come after him and prosecute him. The King family sued him, and they got $1 damages awarded against him by a jury. That was in front of the late Honorable Judge James Swearingen in Circuit Court here in Shelby County. Jowers, big mouth, old-line racist, and that's just part of the urban mythology out there. Attorney Pepper has made a big to-do out of it, but Pepper didn't see everything I did. And the thing of it is Jowers did not have access to a 7.62-308 caliber weapon with a rate of rifling twist, one turn in every 11 and a quarter inches. And he didn't have access to some special custom-loaded ammo that had epoxy in the case to reduce the case capacity so you could make subsonic ammunition. Those things exclude the bozos. They went out and recruited about four or five people to be alternative scapegoats, and they fired them up with, "You will be a great American hero getting rid of this uppity Negro who is causing so much trouble, who is a communist agent." See, that was what they were trying to push.
Okay, and one more question, Judge Brown. When Dexter King met with James Earl Ray before his death, and he said that he forgave him and said that he did not believe that he had anything to do with his father's murder, was he privy to some of the information that you have so eloquently discussed this morning?
Yeah, I've talked to him on several occasions. Matter of fact, if he listens to this, I'm trying to get him. He has my number, or he can reach me in Memphis. But every time I try to get with him through the Family Foundation, they won't make the connection. And by the way, I find it interesting that in spite of the fact that I had a 15-year-long TV show and was either number two or number one rated syndicated show, nobody wanted to interview me in the mainstream media.
I bet they didn't.
Yeah, you know, that just does not happen, you know.
Well, that might change now, sir.
Well, no, this is the first time. By the way, you know who was interested in this about 18 years ago? Was the Vatican. They wanted to do a miniseries on this because of the respect they had for King, but something happened with the Vatican politics. I think the Pope in question took ill. It may have been 15. It may have been 15, 18, 20 years ago. No, it was about 18 years ago. I'm not sure of the exact time, but I know that, you know, I think that's when they lost that Pope and got another one. But anyway, it's been international interest, but nothing here from America.
Well, I don't expect anything to come from America. I mean, when you first did the first show and you dropped some of this information, I mean, man, it was just mind-blowing. And it's amazing how much people don't know that isn't in the history books that you really have a hard time finding. Unless now your YouTube videos, which you've got several of them out there, that are excellent, excellent sources. You guys, you can go Google this Judge Joe Brown and MLK assassination. There's several videos where a lot of what he's talking about here, it's there. I mean, you can see it. He's presenting it. So, I mean, the videos have been out there, but for some reason, you know, people do not want to really rest on this. You know, we just want to say, well, Dr. King was killed at the Rain Motel, and you know, he had a dream, and every February, and they don't want to really dig into it. You know, this is a lot of good information that's coming out here that you really, I mean, I'm privileged to even be exposed to it as all of us. And I suggest people go back and listen to this show and because this is a lot of information and it's a lot.
Well, let me say this too. In 1989 or 90,
the U.S. Congress passed an enabling act, and President George Herbert Walker Bush signed an executive order, which was backed up later by an executive order signed by President Bill Clinton. And they set up a repository, which was located on 14th Street in downtown D.C. And that was a repository for records relative to assassinations or assassination attempts for review and research. You could go in there, pay your fee, and make a request, and they would research and bring the record from any federal agency that was involved forth and certify them. And some of the more intriguing stuff that I find damning for the American media. Now, this stuff is available. I've seen it. And media, of course, being lackadaisical as they are you a mainstream news media? They never jumped on it. But there are actual memoranda that I've laid eyes on, internal FBI memoranda, where they're discussing the efficacy of assassinating King. And the question was not, do we kill him? It's, would he be more dangerous as a dead martyr or as alive, get this, galvanizer for the anti-war movement and as a revitalizer for the labor movement? See, labor was going downhill then, but he was there for a labor strike. That was AFSCME. And this is 1968. That's when the Vietnam War was getting to really, really be rough. And they had had the Tet Offensive, and there was a lot of unrest going on. And this is when Robert Kennedy got assassinated. A lot of things went on in 1968. This is when they had the riot in Chicago at the Democratic Convention. This is where Johnson declined to run for president, saying he would not accept, nor would he, would not offer himself as a candidate for president, nor would he accept the party's nomination. So, you know, there was a lot going on in 1968. This is when Walter Cronkite, who was a very different kind of television journalist, he went to Vietnam and came back with his report that all was not well. So and you did not want.
And excuse me, Judge Brown, in your investigation, did you believe that when Dr. King made the sermon against the Vietnam War that he could not support it anymore, do you believe that that also contributed to his murder?
Well, it had a lot. It didn't have a lot to do with it. They were already having these discussions. Memoranda discussions. And J. Edgar Hoover detested and despised King. I'm sure it didn't help him out. But by the way, that letter they're circulating around on Twitter now about the one that was written to King trying to get him to kill himself, they were going to expose him for some embarrassing things if he did not. Well, he went ahead and did it anyway, and because the FBI was relying upon some manufactured evidence, the letter was disregarded. But there actually was such a letter, and I get that from the authority of some people that were close to King who had some extended discussions with me about it. But they were worried about him galvanizing the anti-war movement and revitalizing labor.
Mm-hmm.
See, King knew that something might happen to him. He was very cognizant of what had happened to Malcolm X. And he had expressed to a number of people that he thought they were going to try to kill him. So Memphis is basically the ideal place to pull off a political assassination, or it still is, really, because they've got a corrupt DA's office who will not conduct any investigation. And the only two black U.S. attorneys they've had in here over the years have been co-opted by promises of federal judgeships. which kept them from doing what they should have done, and they got double-crossed, but that's another story. So you couldn't find a better place. So they went ahead and they got rid of him, but he knew something was going to happen. And when the discussion came up, oh, do you really want to go back to Memphis? Well, you know, if they killed me, I might as well get killed doing something for labor than otherwise. So he came back, and they had him set up. See, there was a thing going on here, a black problem. You had those black people who had been sponsored by old-line whites who, for some reason in the Memphis area, they always wanted their pet Negroes. And they made sure that their pet Negroes advanced, and the pet Negroes kept the pressure down coming from the black community. Then you had some young blacks, the invaders, one of whom, the chairman, is now a PhD, Dr. Kobe Smith. Then you had those who thought they could do it. Then you had another faction that wanted King to help him out. So one faction didn't want him there because they could do it. And then one faction didn't want him there because their white sponsor said no. And then some said, well, let him come. We need all the help we can get. Now, a good friend of mine, the late Judge Otis Higgs, who used to be chief counsel for the NAACP chapter here, related to me before he died an incident during a meeting where he said, I dived beneath a desk I was sitting behind because the Negroes had pulled guns on each other up in an NAACP meeting. The two factions being those who didn't want King and those who said King was coming.
Mm-hmm.
He said, so there was a bad thing going on in the black community itself.
Hmm. Let me get
Ty Dunmore in here, the co-host.
Come on in here, Ty.
You know, I'm listening and taking it all in, and it's just indicative of the system that we live in, this government, unfortunately. People, with all the phenomenal, undisputable facts that Judge Joe Brown has laid out and continues to lay out, most people are not interested in the truth and what the facts are. We have been conditioned, socially conditioned, to believe in things. And I've heard people say, oh, he's a conspirator, he's got this conspiracy theory and all this stuff. No. What Judge Joe Brown is doing for all our listeners is laying out facts. And it's just like anything else. We rather go with the theories. We look up to theorists, so to speak. And when I mean theorists, some of your top leaders that we want to call leaders, for us, for whatever reason, they happen to be people that study theology, theories. They don't teach literally facts. So when Judge Joe Brown lays out all this, it's enlightening. Well, I've already known what he said for quite some time. It's nothing but the truth. I mean, how much more truth do people need to hear to accept what is the truth and not go by what the medium controls, which we have known from early, when I say early, even before the 60s, even though we had groups that rose up that said that the media was the opiate of the masses. So there, we have a opiate crisis when it comes to even accepting information, because they were to lure people to sleep and have people on drugs. And when I mean that drug is a theory, most people don't want the facts. So you can ask this judge time and time again, is it going to change what you, and I'm going to say it real clear, believe, or are you now going to embrace and accept now what you know? Obvious, this man, this brother, this elder, this judge knows what he's talking about. This ain't about a belief. This is scientific evidence. This is forensic science. This is firsthand eyewitness account. Because he was on the case. He studied it. But the majority of people are going to fall for the narrative that's controlled by the mass media that James Earl Ray, even though he went through his grave saying, I never did this, and as the judge so eloquently broke it down, he was just a scapegoat. And you wonder why people don't trust his government to this very day?
Let me say something about that. I have to interject this. The FBI, we have the spectacle of the Black Caucus up there, you know, just staunch supporters of the FBI because Trump's going out. If there is one racist institution in the U.S. government founded on the basis of racism, for the purpose of racism, to get a black man, it is the FBI. See, the Federal Bureau of Investigation came into being before World War I. The purpose? They were very angry at Jack Johnson, that African-American, that black world heavyweight boxing champion that Trump just got through pardoning. See, Jack Johnson did not like white folk. He used to love beating the crap out of them in the ring. And the further this is like, he would flaunt the fact that all of these white women just loved him. And he wound up with a white wife. Some say it was just his girlfriend. Some say it is his wife. But my research indicated it was his legitimate wife. Well, they had what developed to be the Mann Act that Congress came up with that made it a federal offense to take women across state lines for illicit purposes. They came up with the Mann Act to get Jack Johnson, and they did. But the FBI got formed as a precursor to investigate this. So they didn't get investigating. They didn't get formed to investigate serious crime. They got investigated. They got created to investigate black man taking white women across state lines. So incidentally, how they convicted Jack Johnson was he and his wife or lady friend were on the way to Europe, and they had to go across a corner of Georgia in a train. So Georgia did not allow nor recognize interracial marriages. So when Jack Johnson and his wife got on the other side of Georgia going to a seaport, the federales arrested him, charging him with Mann Act violations. They convicted him. He got 1 year. He escaped. Jumped bond, went to Europe, stayed in France until his mother, and I think this is despicable, she said, oh, baby, I want to see you before I die. And she talked him into coming back to America, where he served that prison sentence and then was released. He got killed in a car wreck in 1946. But in any event, the FBI got set up to investigate black men screwing white women. That's its purpose. Now, J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover's first real assignment was interviewing the prostitutes in the New York brothels. So he got blackmail information on all of the who's who types in American politics at that point in time. Now, there is something about J. Edgar Hoover that is now coming out. In fact, I saw something on the History Channel about it not long ago. You know, our worst enemy is sometimes one of us. Well, J. Edgar Hoover's parents had to leave Louisiana. Guess what? They were being accused of passing for white, and the Klan burned a bunch of crosses on his parents' property. And if you look at a young J. Edgar Hoover, he doesn't look like that liver-spotted old white man everybody's used to seeing. He looks very much like he could be a close brother of Harold Ford Jr., the congressman from the 9th District in Tennessee. And Hoover was black. So you got a black man had a pathological hatred of another black man. Just one of them was passing, and his parents had been passing. And if you look at his parents, it's obvious they're black folk, just fair-skinned black folk, not white folk. So you got a Negro hating himself, hating everybody else that looked like him. And that's the same thing you have, with due respect, with this Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, who hates the devil out of his own people. His mother was a prostitute. His daddy's father, who was a rich black man, adopted him. And he doesn't want any part of what, you know, that indicates about himself. You know, think about it. You know who his best man was at his last wedding? Rush Limbaugh. Now, that's who Clarence Thomas had as his best man. That just gives you some idea about his character. I don't want to get off and digress into him. I know something about him. They tried to recruit me to Yale Law School because I could get in the front door, and they wanted to set up a minority admissions program. When they tried to recruit me, there was five feet of snow on the ground, and I said, no, I'm staying in California at UCLA. And some years later, when they got Clarence Thomas in there, he got in under an affirmative action program, and then he flunked out. But what happened is nobody was supposed to flunk out of Yale, so to redeem himself, they sent him around that summer to talk against affirmative action, and he badmouthed it for the rest of his law school career. And then they gave him a job in where since he went to Yale, he didn't have to take the bar for this state. And he was in the state attorney's office and supposedly in the tax section, but he did no tax work, didn't go to court. They had him traipsing all around the country, bad-mouthing affirmative action that he got in Yale under. See, so we've got all kinds of things where we've got blacks in the federal system who hate themselves and hate others like them. See, the only thing Hoover hated worse progress than black people was the Klan. So we had black people in Memphis against King, wanted to set him up. Somebody black, and he had two or three of them who helped set him up. And a black man passing for white running a federal agency to take out his spleen on what he was, hopefully by being so anti-black, nobody would realize what he was. You know, you got brothers, you know, that are fair skinned that look less black than J. Edgar Hoover looked. Just look at his pictures. And he was gay, mm-hmm. and he hated the devil out of the fact that a lot of people were holding that over his head. And he was corrupt because the mafia let him gamble all he wanted without having to pay up his debts. And you know how the integrity he had. He knows they exist because they let him gamble in their places. So he goes mm-hmm. around for years saying there's no such thing until they raided this meeting they had up in the I'm digressing. But anyway, you got somebody that hated himself, hated another black man because he was too black, and who came up with the myth to get himself a little bit of extra play and more power that the communists were out there trying to control the black churches and the civil rights struggle or whatever it was, movement was nothing but a communist front.
But Judge, we're getting down to the end. Can you take a couple minutes? You got a show coming up, a brand new show, besides the Judge Joe Brown show with Valerie, and we're going to talk about that one. But can you tell us a little bit about your new show that's coming up?
Oh, yeah. It'll be called Hot Topics. And it will be me and some women, and it will be sort of like The View, but there's a man involved, me, the rooster in the hen house, so to speak, and the women are a lot deeper than the ones you see on The View, and they're finer, too. So it'll be interesting. We're going to have a six-week pilot. It'll be a weekend show, and if we get the support we need in the ratings, and they'll make it a weekly strip Monday through Friday. So
yes, sir.
Check me out with Hot Topics.
And where do we get you Twitter? And
you can find me on Twitter at Judge Joe Brown TV. And I do not have a blue check, but it's me. We've been talking about a little thing I put out there of if somebody doesn't want to give you payback for your votes, then don't vote for them.
You know, stop going for lesser of two evils. You know, the Republicans are so bad, you can't afford to vote for them. You'll have to vote for us. And then we get nothing except for the 16 months before the last 2016 election. We got the Democrats debating on who got the piss in the boys' bathroom, wasting all that political capital. That's not us. You know, we get nothing. We vote for them over and over again, and they don't deliver a damn thing for us. They don't deal with education, employment, prison reform. They don't deal with getting folk off of welfare into workfare so they can fit into the real live world instead of being on a dependent form of slavery. You know, we don't get anything about, you know, let's deal with setting up some kind of standards in what these children are allowed to hear. You don't deal with realistic education. You know, it's crazy.
It is.
But,
it's
you know, we're
America
supposed to
right
vote.
Now.
Forget you. You can't vote for anybody else, so we own you. Well, you know, gay folk have their rights, but, you know, we've been the longest-term perpetual victim of American racism, which has not stopped. How about if you continue to work on us first before we get asked to go support somebody else and move them up a little higher on the totem pole and us a little further down? You know, enough
that's
is enough.
Right, and
so,
that's why I love being on your show with Valerie and you know, and we're gonna talk about that. You know, the Judge Joe Brown Show for everybody. It's every Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's 5 p.m. Central. And the calling number over there is 929-477.
No, it's 3 p.m. Central. Other way around. 3 p.m. Central, 4 East Eastern Standard.
Yeah, my time. And that's hosted by Valerie Denise Jones. She's on my Facebook, and I share the show up there so you guys can catch the link and hit the follow button. And she also does another show called Big Exclusives. It's also on Fridays. And yesterday she had Christopher Williams on, who's a music artist, and also he was in the movie New Jack City. He played the character Hakeem Akbar. And he very interesting conversation, good show. And on the judge's show yesterday, Judge, I think you were busy. We lit it up over there.
I had some technical difficulties. I couldn't get in.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, we lit it up over there. It was good.
Yeah, I was disappointed, but, you know, things happen.
Yes, sir. Well, I appreciate you being there and always being there. And I just wanted to remind everybody that didn't get a chance to catch it on Facebook or here at 94.5 The Beat here in Central Texas, that on February 28th will be my last day. I'll be retiring February 28th. And I wanted to give a shout-out to all the people in, you know, in the city of Waco and even on Facebook that are supporting me. We're going to keep doing the shows. We're actually going to step the game up. But I need to spend a little bit more time with my wife and getting the show balanced and getting everything up top-notch, put the best product out. So we're just transitioning from one format to another. We're going to keep our nose to the grindstone, and we're going to keep bringing you real truth and real shows. And, you know,
well,
the judge will always be there.
And I adopted
yes,
you.
Yes,
hey,
sir.
I adopted you, or we
dad,
adopted
sir.
Each other.
And I tell you, he answers the phone when I call at 1 and 2 in the morning. So, you know, you doesn't get any better than that. But, Judge, I appreciate you, Pop. Thanks for coming in and dropping all that knowledge. I'm going to have to go back and listen to this one this evening myself.
All right, son. Proud of what you're doing. You really, you know, you're going the extra 9 yards on this.
Yes, sir.
Really impressive. I like behind
you,
the blue curtain. It's a good thing.
Well, I'm going to try. I need to get you a shirt and a hoodie and send it out to you. And then when I get ready to move back that way, we have to pop in and spend some time. When me and the wife
all right,
move back
I'm
that way.
I'm going to get you, if we can get this thing going, I'm going to get you on this show because we need to interview you.
Yes, sir. Well, I appreciate it. If you need anything, you know where to reach me.
All right. And remember, it's all in our own hands. Nobody else can be expected to take these large steps that we need to have taken. So let's take them ourselves. And if you're going to
take these large steps, you have to be fit to take these steps, which means you're going to have to do the preparation. You got to get the head together, Amen. The body together, and your soul together so you can Amen. Make the moves you need to make to get where you need to get. So let's keep struggling. Let's keep pushing. Let's do it. We have been our own worst enemy. We need to get courage and bravery in our souls is something that we must be willing to die for so we can do what we need to do to get where we need to get. All right? That's
Amen,
my sign
Papa,
off.
I appreciate
message.
You so much.
All right, brother. Have a great day.
Yes, sir.
I'm out
too.
Of here.
We're about to... Yes, sir.
So you heard the news on the radio? Is that the way you heard it? So you were driving, you left that gas station at 2nd and Linden, what, about 6 or?
I don't have any way of knowing. I think it's around that time, but I don't even know if it's Linden. I know the approximate area it is.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the map on the Inquirer.
And you were going back to pick up this man that you say is Raul? Is
no, way? I just waiting the car back.
So you heard all this confusion, turned and flipped on the radio. They said Dr. King's been shot. Did you think you were set up at that point?
No, I was headed toward New Orleans when I had the radio on. I used to keep the radio on. I think I didn't have too strong feelings about the shooting.
When you met Raul, you didn't know any other name for him. That's the name that he said was his, and that's all you ever knew.
Yeah, I did. Kiss him.
Mm-hmm. And you met him where?
Canada.
Up in Canada. Yeah. And you just met in a saloon, or?
It was a saloon in a waterfront area of Montreal.
Mm-hmm. You never became good friends then?
No, I wasn't good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Just business.
Mm-hmm.
These were all aliases, I assume.
You don't think Raul was a real name at all, then, huh?
No, I've got some Freedom of Information papers in there saying there's Raul San Diego or something. New Orleans is supposed to be him, but I don't have the FBI. It's material from the FBI files, but I don't have nothing to substantiate that.
So you think their mind was made up when they got you?
Well, it had to be made up. They couldn't... Well, I don't know what, if there's any penalty for extraditing someone fraudulently or not, but I think I can see their legal point where they've got to stick with their story.
Mm-hmm.
Ladies and gentlemen, please sit back because you are now about to go behind the blue curtain.
Get down.